Hello and welcome to the Armenian News Network Gurung Week in Review. I'm Aspet Bedrosyan, and along with Hovik Manucharyan, this week we're going to talk about the following major topics. Pashinyan goes to Moscow, election politics, the POW debacle, a coronavirus update, and the state of the economy.
And to talk about these issues, we have with us Aspet Kochikyan, who is an associate professor of political science and international relations at the American University of Armenia, and Hrant Mikhaelian, a political scientist and multidisciplinary researcher in social sciences based in Yerevan. He's also a senior researcher at the Caucasus Institute. This episode was recorded on Monday, April 12, 2021. Hello and welcome, everyone.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Hovik.
Hello.
So to begin, let's talk about Pashinyan's trip to Moscow. So Prime Minister Pashinyan went to Moscow and met Putin in person on April 7. Pashinyan mentioned that many issues in the public part of his speech, including POWs, security, the Russian vaccine, and energy, and including Russian support for building a nuclear power plant. Russia mainly seemed to communicate the need for implementation of the November 10 ceasefire agreement as a priority. Aspet Kochikyan, what's your analysis on the meeting? Was Pashinyan able to come back from the meeting with any significant gains for Armenia?
Well, at least in terms of public, I don't think there was any significant gain or anything mentioned. There are a couple of issues that followed at the meeting, namely the issue of POWs, which I think we're going to talk about, but also the issue of vaccines, which we're also going to talk about. But I think probably one of the main issues that was not announced and was probably discussed as well is the upcoming snap elections in Armenia. And to a large extent, I think this was also an attempt by Pashinyan to feel what is Putin's perception and what are Putin's expectations from Pashinyan, or probably also pledge his allegiance to Moscow even more. Which reminds me, it's quite fascinating that the analogies, if you were to look at different places as well in similar situations. In Lebanon, for instance, for the longest time, every time there was a major decision to be made by parliamentarians or by the parliament to elect a new president, the road between Beirut and Damascus would have been filled with the official cars trying to get curry favors from the Syrian capital. So I think this is one of the components also to keep in mind, that the reason why Pashinyan was in Moscow. Also, I do have to mention,
Kochikyan was also in Moscow last week as well, right?
He was in Moscow last week, but he also, was he in Moscow? But he also had a conversation. I wasn't sure about his Moscow trip, but he did have a conversation with Putin on the phone. At least that was what reported in Armenian news sources. So I think this is all gearing up for the upcoming elections. Everyone is gearing up for the upcoming elections and trying to feel what is Putin's and what is Russia's perspective.
I think they're all taking the temperature of Moscow.
Exactly. As is Moscow doing the same thing, vice versa, right? So a lot depends on that, even though Russia does mention that they're not interested in intervening in internal Armenian politics. But obviously, if Putin were to send unfavorable messages that I don't want this person, or, maybe we'll see, rather than a wholehearted support, then it might become quite an interesting race.
Has that ever been the case? I think that most of the time Moscow has been able to keep hands off Armenian politics, at least during elections.
Most of the time, Hovik, but these are not most of the times now. I think to a large extent, the polarization of politics in Armenia, as well as the pro-Russian sentiments, as well as, in some circles, anti-Russian sentiments, might make Moscow more interested in betting on a sure horse. This is always, at times like these, it's always interesting to remember what Molotov, the Soviet diplomat, has once said, that the problem with free elections is that you don't know who's going to win. I think, Putin specifically wouldn't want to leave anything to chance.
This time, the Kremlin specifically confirmed the conversation that Putin had with Kochikyan. In fact, they referred to the existing friendship between the two leaders. And then they added that the interest between Russia and Armenia being a constant, they would work with whoever got elected by the people of Armenia.
Well, exactly. I mean, in other words, whoever's going to be elected, they're going to be pro-Russian. They're going to do whatever we tell them to do.
The Posner interview with Kocharyan was interesting. I would recommend people listen to that. But in that Posner interview, Kocharyan was asked if he met with Putin or if he had a conversation, and Kocharyan just smiled. But only like the day after that, the Kremlin confirmed that there was a phone conversation. The other thing I guess we should talk about is the mention of the nuclear power plant, which caused some headlines. But we all know it's not very cheap to build a nuclear power plant. And I think that in order to raise something at a head of state level like that, shouldn't there be some kind of a, documenting, intentions or, investment guarantees? How does Pashinyan plan on making that a reality, if that is really was his intention, and if not a pre-election campaign promise?
Well, intention is one thing, Cody. Well, the other thing is that in this context, probably it's also about measuring the temperature for that as well. I mean, the issue of building a new nuclear power plant has been on the in discussions for a while now, concerns or even attempts to get European Union funding for that. It might not be something that they have thought through. Rather, it's just trying to feel around, see if Moscow would be interested or Russia would be interested in building a nuclear power plant.
But you don't do that. You don't do that publicly, though, right? I mean, before, unless you have some guarantees that you won't get rejected anyway.
Well, there's more than just the political aspect to this endeavor. It has to make economic sense for the Russians to invest in such a century-scale enterprise. I mean, look at our existing power plant, which is coming onto a half-century mark, right? If you're going to invest in such a wide-scope project, you need to make sure that there are committed customers for decades to come, and it has to be at agreed price points, and so you need agreements with neighboring countries as your market, Georgia, Iran, Turkey. I think this is something that Serge Sargsyan's government was working on almost a decade ago, but that fell through as the whole football diplomacy collapsed.
It's not something new, It's in the past 10-15 years, Armenia actually has done a lot of power sort of exchange, literally power exchange between Iran and Armenia, and especially seasonally. Usually in the summers, Armenia would be exporting energy, and in the winters it would be importing it. Or I think it might have been the vice versa with Iran specifically, and they've upgraded the electricity grid for the export of power. But also the discussion of power plants or also electricity production, one has to remember that Russia directly or indirectly controls a majority of the power plants in Armenia, be that the nuclear power plant or also hydroelectric and carbon-based thermal power plants. So that would guarantee their control of the Armenian energy sector, power sector.
Well, we need a deeper dive into the energy sector because 30 out of 36 hydropower plants in Artsakh and its regions were lost to Azerbaijan in the war. So Armenia's energy production profile is no longer the same as it was even 6-7 months ago. Some of the information was from my conversation with Arek Danagulyan yesterday when he was mentioning that in 2012 Serge Sargsyan was trying to make these agreements, but things didn't pan out, and if it economically we're not going to have customers for the electricity, it's not going to make enough sense to put out like $5 to $10 billion and take 5 to 10 years to build this thing. I want to say that this is actually a pretty good confidence building measure if people want to build confidence between Armenia and Turkey. Open the border in the sense that, electricity can be exchanged. They can buy our electricity and maybe we can buy some of their goods. In that sense, there's a little bit of equity in the economic trade, right? And that's, let's call that confidence building. I personally see if there's the money, if people come through, sure, let's do it. But how is it actually going to come through?
I don't know. I think that it all depends on, supply versus demand. For instance, if Armenia is going to have a huge growth in economy and,
a doubling, you think? Whatever,
doubling or whatever. Let's say we have this national project and we need to get Armenia back to its feet and mm-hmm. everyone's going to invest. I think then, we will have more requirements for power internally even.
By the way, I agree. I totally agree with you.
We could install a huge Bitcoin mining farm right next to the nuclear power plant and consume all the excess energy.
You don't even need to. We're talking about a 25 to 50 year investment here. The economy will double. I mean, there's either not going to be in Armenia or it's going to double in size.
Yeah, exactly. It's,
right? So look at the Weaver 440 we have. It was, 1976, was it? 1974. It's almost 50 years old. Half a century investment here.
Yeah, so let me ask the question, I guess, head on to you. What did you find in this interesting in this meeting between Pashinyan and Putin? We talked about, obviously, the nuclear power plant. I wanted to get your thoughts on that. And which other topics piqued your interest?
Well, if we start from the whole discussion, I think pretty much nothing was interesting, because the agenda looked promisable, but in reality we don't see any repercussions. So in reality, I don't think something really interesting happened there. So the meeting was there. So as already has been mentioned, that sides sketched up. There have been a lot of discussions on Armenian side, but I haven't seen anything being discussed on Russian side. So generally, I don't know, maybe it was some unofficial agenda, maybe something on POWs, but POWs, but I don't think something really important to Russia happened, and something which Russia is going to pursue happened on these discussions. So generally it was, a meeting devoted to more or less Karabakh developments, and especially corridor discussion and so on. And concerning nuclear power plant, I think generally it is an important topic, especially in terms of, Armenia's energy vulnerability, as already has been mentioned, because Armenian side lost a lot of power plants in Artsakh. Also, because the the troubles with some types of energy are going to increase, and mineral energy is probably going to lose its place, and also Armenia's economy is going to grow anyway, so we will need increase of power production. The problem is that this discussion on Pashinyan's side is purely populist, and I'll try to explain why. Last year, about 10 months ago, Armenia rejected a 60 million Russian loan, which was provided on very preferential terms, and did not repair its power plant. So if it was rejected then and nothing has changed, I don't think that in reality we are going to see any progress here. So generally it was just a pre-election topic and nothing more. So on one side, Armenia really needs this. So the agenda which Pashinyan brought to the public is important agenda to Armenia. But what will happen on the ground between the states and in economy, I think nothing will follow.
All right, let's move on to election politics. So we're seeing political actors big and small gearing up for the elections. Prime Minister Pashinyan is touring Armenian regions and meeting with voters. Many new political parties seem to be forming. Robert Kocharyan, who is now free of the main prosecution against him, has announced that he'll be running in the upcoming election as part of a bloc. Some see the upcoming electoral contest as being mainly between two blocs, the incumbent MyStep, and on the other side, the forces allied with Robert Kocharyan. Others balk at the idea that any of the formers, the so-called Nakhkins, have a chance to even run in these elections. Aspet Kochigyan, how do you see these elections shaping up? Is it going to be a bipolar battle between the incumbent MyStep on one side and political powers allied with Kocharyan on the other? Or do you think there will be more diversity in the participation?
One thing fascinates me about elections in Armenia is that up until even sometimes as early as a month before election, you cannot predict anything. unlike what you see in U.S. elections or anywhere else, where it takes, you know, 6, 7, 8 months in terms of consolidation of powers, coalitions, and so on and so forth. As of now, you are right in the sense that while Kocharyan, based on the polls, he is the main contender. He is the main sort of contender and the main challenger of Nikol Pashinyan and his ruling bloc. He doesn't seem to have managed to get the explicit support from the other sort of the opposition parties, including Barkava Chayastan, as well as Republican Party or the ARF. I wouldn't exclude the fact that probably of those, the ARF might be the Dashnak Chuchun might be the most guaranteed to endorse him in a party list. But if he were to run on a list like only based on that, his chances, Kocharyan's chances, would not be be great. So it would be, there's a lot to see, there's a lot to wait and see in this context.
Yeah, and I wanted to also mention that I believe I read an article where there seemed to be some, I guess, hesitancy from the Republican Party side to outright support Kocharyan. But in general, I think the opposition will not be united or will not be presenting a unified front. As we said, Prosperous Armenia will run by itself, and we're seeing other opposition parties making their own bids. So, Hrant, I wanted to ask you, despite this fragmented structure, do you think that the opposition will have some kind of a unified strategy that they can coordinate on? And if so, would this strategy be to get enough smaller parties and blocs in parliament such that they wouldn't be able to form a coalition after the elections and essentially get 50+1%?
Thanks for your question. I think opposition in reality does not have a strategy. So they hope to form a coalition, to have many parties in the parliament. But the problem is that for forming a coalition, you need three, if I'm not mistaken, according to the law, you cannot form coalition of, let's say, 20 parties. You need three, not more, parties. That's first thing. Second thing is that opposition did not count its chances, did not count social landscape, and they don't want to go after it. They think it's all fake. You could see it from their statements and interviews. So they don't really understand which fields they are playing with. So in reality, I think opposition has no strategy and just hopes to win this or that way. This is big problem because Armenian political landscape is fragmented as ever. It has never been this fragmented. So you have one poll which is one side, let's say, which is government side, and there is no second part, there is no counterpart. So yes, on one hand you can see Kocharyan, who is, let's say, most prominent within the opposition, and I agree that it will be black and white again because it's beneficial for both. But on the other hand, opposition is very fragmented, so I think generally Pashinyan has very good chances to win within current system. Also, agreeing with the statement that nothing is clear before the elections, I can say even more that even the very fact of elections is not clear, because elections have not been set. Pashinyan has not resigned, and he also has a good experience in cancelling the elections. I don't think it will be very likely, the cancelling the elections, but still it is possible.
Hrant, do you think that has to do with the technicality? I believe that per the constitution, the elections have to be within 60 days of the resignation, right? So if Pashinyan were to resign now, the elections would have to be earlier in June. And if they're thinking about June 20th, so he can't resign before April 20th or something like that.
Agreed, but also he has not declared the date when he's going to resign. And when he was asked, he said, I don't know the exact date yet.
Right, he said in April.
Yeah, I think that's of no consequence, but I don't think that is of consequence. But also the thing is that when Kocharyan explicitly mentioned that he is interested in running, he legitimized the elections. Because if you remember the rhetoric before that by the different the 17 plus opposition, which Hrant correctly mentioned that they don't have a strategy per se. They were trying to probably go in the path of boycotting the elections. But when Kocharyan explicitly mentioned that he will be, if there were elections, he would run, I think that also changed the electoral landscape and the possibility of coalitions and so on.
Let me ask both of you a question. You said that the opposition does not seem to have a real strategy. Do either of you think that the government, the incumbent government, has a strategy?
Well, no one has a strategy, I think, in Armenia. I think that's the advantage that the government has is that they're incumbents. So they don't need to have a strategy. They just need to cover up their goof-ups, basically.
But Aspet, do you think that MyStep specifically will be working to, at least, for instance, I know they will be hoping for an absolute majority, but do you think they have a chance to get absolute majority? Or are they also like the opposition hoping to have like a few minor parties support them in a coalition? And let's also remind that the core thing that was changed for the electoral code was the proportional representation. The minimum threshold is still 5%. So, and you have to have 5%
right.
as a party to get into the parliament.
Right. Well, they don't need to have an absolute majority. They need to have just a majority. I mean, in terms of technicality, in terms of terminology, absolute majority is, way above 50%. So they can have a plurality. Now, yes, you're right. It all depends on the landscape. If there will be several other parties that would be in the parliament, then MyStep might be able to make a coalition with other parties to have enough votes to get the government ratified. So that all depends, again, on the landscape, which parties are going to be in. If it ends up being similar to the current landscape, parliamentary landscape, that's not going to happen, unless Marukyan pulls a fast one, and he basically argues that by doing so, by joining the coalition, he's making sure that the political stability and so on. I think in this whole thing, Marukyan is the loose cannon, probably, if you can call it that.
Hovig, have you seen any data that could indicate how many parties would clear the 5% threshold if the elections were held today?
If I remember correctly, the only political actors that had above 5% are MyStep, Robert Kocharyan, and maybe Gagik Tsarukyan as of now.
And don't forget that in the event of a coalition, it's 7%, the threshold. Or an electoral bloc, it would be a faction, it would be 7%.
Right. The funny part is when we say that Robert Kocharyan, we don't know if that's a party or it's a bloc or what it is.
No, he said it's going to be bloc, and they're widely speculating that one of the members of the bloc will be this newly forming party in SUNY. I guess we don't know who the other one is, but a lot of people are guessing it might be the ARF. So when Pashinyan flew back from Moscow, there were a lot of, shortly afterwards, there were a lot of leaks related to POWs, and everyone was hoping for something. On Thursday, April 8th, in the evening, a Russian airplane flew, apparently from Baku, though that's not clear, flew from Azerbaijan to the Erebuni airport. Shortly before the arrival of the airplane, Armenian social media exploded with news of the return. A large group of POWs being flown in by the head of the Russian peacekeepers in Artsakh, General Rustam Muradov. Yet the plane arrived empty. The news seems to have been leaked by several sources in the government. But General Muradov essentially said that no POW return was planned on the flight and called those spreading such news as liars and provocateurs. And the following day, angry mobs surrounded the Ministry of Defense, and they were able to successfully block entry and exit of MOD employees for the entire day, I guess, or for more than 24 hours. Hrant, what key pieces did I just miss, in describing this story, and what is your overall impression here?
I think there is just one point you have missed out of it. It's that according to flight radar, the plane came directly from Russia. So why did they decide that it's coming from Baku and it has POWs on there? I don't know. And this is a big problem. I think it can be incompetence. It can be whatever you might decide. But I mean, the whole hype around this plane was orchestrated for no specific reason. So I think this is problem. It shows also incompetence, because if you are meeting the plane which is coming from Russia and you expect it to be from Baku and you can't track it through flight radar but you are bringing whole journalist staff and so on there. I mean, it's hard to understand the logic. Maybe there is something I also don't know, but at least the very fact that it came from Russia, I think makes it very problematic to understand what was there in reality.
But hold on, in adding to what you were saying, isn't it also possible that this is yet another manifestation of the media feeding on gossip and whatnot rather than doing any investigative work? Granted, you know, this might have been for any hidden reason, but, you know, why have so many journalists going there? And as you said, they could have just gone on flight tracker and figured it out. Everyone's doing it these days.
This is just not just gossip. There were two government spokespersons, Pashinyan spokesperson, Manda Gevorkyan, I believe.
And Tigran Avinyan.
Tigran Avinyan. And also parliamentarian Nazali Baghdasaryan. There were reports that she herself called the families of the POWs to go to the airport and wait for their boys there. So this was just not gossip, in my opinion.
They expected POWs to be there, and they asked the governmental media to be there to show it online. And this is the problem. I mean, it's really hard to understand what were they expecting to get, and
maybe they also, they were pulled a fast one on them as well. Because you're right. I mean, this is a government that needs any kind of a positive media, and this has actually embarrassed them more than anything. So it wouldn't be past the, we shouldn't put past the fact that, you know, they might have gotten wrong information from whatever source, and they ran with it, and it blew up in their face.
I'm in agreement, Asbed. I mean, all these government people jumping in and being embarrassed tells me that they were either misled or misinformed at the start as well.
Is it possible that the government itself was engaged in misinformation? I sometimes have the misfortune to monitor some of these fake YouTube channels. And immediately after the incident, they started blasting everywhere that Russia, failed us. They're conspiring with Azerbaijan to hold our prisoners hostage. Yeah, it just seems like a very weird episode.
But Ovik, that would again feed into what Asbed was saying, right? They're trying to find sort of scapegoats for that.
I think they almost tried to go for a election PR stunt, basically, with these POWs returning, and suddenly just blew up in their face.
But if you know that they're not returning, and I think there is no conclusive
but
evidence.
You don't
that
they
know.
Had, but
they
you
didn't
don't know.
They didn't know it was yeah. They were not returning.
If we're saying that we don't know that the POWs were returning, then we're essentially saying that the Russians played a trick on Pashinyan.
Well, it sounds like somebody threw somebody under the bus, maybe, or there was just plain misinformation.
And the government, Armenian government, threw the Russians under the bus, or tried to throw the Russians under the bus. They tried to find someone else on
I think it's fair to say, I think it's one of those two. Like, I think either the Russians try to throw the Armenians under the bus, or the Armenians are trying to throw the Russians on the bus and, like, trying to increase public pressure.
I think it was remarkable also that Muradov said that your government is basically lying and misinforming you, rather than saying there was some misinformation or somebody didn't have the right information. I think he saw that the Armenian government was then trying to throw the Russians under the bus and basically responded aggressively.
Also, there, let me say, there were rumors, and sorry for spreading that, but there were some rumors that there was talk between Putin, Pashinyan and Aliyev, and Putin wanted to bring some POWs, but Aliyev rejected. And indirectly, we can see that, because immediately after the expectations of POWs coming to Armenia here in Yerevan, in Baku there was a small protest actions with the wordings "Russians go home," and also today already Aliyev was talking about Iskander M, which was according to him used by Armenian side, which was previously rejected by Russian side. So there were several indicators that there are misagreements and misunderstanding between Moscow and Baku. And I think Armenian side also overestimated the ability of Russia to resolve this issue. So they were expecting that if Putin decided to bring POWs, he can easily do that. So I think it was also a miscalculation based also on incompetence, because in reality, Russia has limited tools for affecting Baku directly. Of course, it can push more, let's say, use more pressure and so on, but to some extent. And what can Russia do if the words are not enough? So here is a question. So I think Armenian government has just also miscalculated Russia's ability to decide things here in the region.
Rant, it is clear to me that Aliyev wants something for the returns of the POWs that was not in the November agreement. Can you speculate? Do you know what that could be?
There were several speculations in media on that, which includes several points, major of which is a package of some territories which were part of Azerbaijani SSR in Soviet times, including two exclaves in Tavush and one in Ararat. So according to these media publications, this is what Aliyev wants. So he still wants to get more territories, and Pashinyan tries not to go there, but has no more tools to give in exchange, because he lost time when Armenia still had Azerbaijani POWs, and most importantly still had two Syrians, which is unclear where they are now, but it posed a big threat to Baku's international image. And we don't know how was the process of their, let's say, exchange or how they left Armenia, but I assume there was some exchange process which included this informally.
Aspet, what do you think?
No, I agree with Harant. I mean, again, it's all about based on speculation and so on. And this is also the problem in Armenia, and Harant rightfully mentioned it and pointed it out, that there are so much expectation, you know, waiting for the savior complex that Armenian political mind has always had throughout history. It's also repeated now and accentuated now with the fact that everyone expects that Putin will find a solution for everything. The fact is that Putin is playing the long game. He's also thinking about developments in Ukraine and so on. He already has boots on the ground. He doesn't care much about the small, you know, quarrels that are POWs and this and that. You know, they don't care if it's 1,000. Even if there were 1,000 POWs there, they don't. He doesn't care. He got what he wanted. So I think it also shows the immaturity of the overall Armenian political sort of mind.
I'm going to throw in my two cents. Azerbaijani press has been full of complaints that Armenians are not providing minefield maps around Qarabagh and regions. And I was wondering if that's what they want in exchange for the POWs.
I mean, that's one of the issues that I've heard. The other is, I mean, these are all speculatory, but the other is like the area around the road around Garmishuka to get easier to Shushi.
Yeah, I don't have more information either.
Me neither, but this is one thing we know exactly. Azerbaijan wants these territories and definitely wants to have this road. So it theoretically might be that this information is not correct. Theoretically, it might be, but also we know for sure that Azerbaijan does want it, because we see it a lot in discussions in Azerbaijan and in Azerbaijani media, which is basically government controlled. So I think it might have some grounds, but what exactly is the package? This is a big question. So I think these details might be within the package, but what is the whole package itself? This is bigger question. And also I want to drop in one issue which we should also note, which is that Russian peacekeepers still have no official status within Azerbaijan. as far as I know. So Azerbaijan still did not provide fully legal guarantees for Russian presence there.
So their presence is not ratified? I thought that was done by the November agreement.
No, they're working on a more detailed mandate between Russians and Azerbaijan.
Yeah.
Moving on, after nearly 2 months during which COVID numbers in Armenia improved, infections and deaths have picked up significantly over the last 2 to 3 weeks, maybe a month. We're currently registering over 1,000 new infections a day and 15 to 25 deaths. Armenia's healthcare system is again stretched thin. We heard a week ago that 24,000 AstraZeneca vaccines have arrived, and this week 15,000 Sputnik V vaccines were donated to Armenia the day after Pashinyan met with Putin. Those are the numbers. Despite the situation, Anahita Avanesyan, the Minister of Health, said that they are on track with their game plan. I was shocked to hear this. Hrant, there's a game plan? What is the game plan?
Well, it's hard to say if there is any plan because from what we can see, the virus spreads naturally. I mean, the only thing which stops it is a portion of herd immunity which has been achieved within the population. And the second thing might be the weather, and it will affect more and more the situation starting from June. So generally, I yet cannot see any plan, and I could not see it from the very beginning when on January 30 of 2020, the Commission on Coronavirus was formed within the government.
One of the factors, if I may add in, butt in here, if to put it mildly, I think there are a couple of also other factors that determine the rise or can explain the rise. It's the, you know, the nonchalant or the cavalier attitude that people have towards this. And as Hrant mentioned, that, oh yeah, it's like, okay, they have, there's a herd immunity and so on, without considering that there are already different variants of the virus. One of the more recent conversations I had with an acquaintance who's in the medical field mentioned that the British variant has already been in Armenia, and I personally know a couple of people from my institution who have actually caught the virus, and it has been heavier than the usual. Now, that being said, the Minister of Health, Avanesyan, Anahita Avanesyan, actually also mentioned that they're going to start full vaccinations as of mid-April, and they even talked about saying that people above 54 will get the AstraZeneca and people below that will get the Sputnik V. So these are all speculations, right?
But Asped, what does full vaccination mean? At 30 or 40,000 vaccines, it's barely enough to cover 2 or 3% of the population.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's what they were saying, actually, in a sense that they are going to get more. They're hopeful that they're going to get more and so on. I mean, that's hope is the thing that actually is really beating
right.
us apart.
And that's exactly, I mean, my concern was exactly what the question was. What is the game plan? And I'm not aware of the game plan.
Yeah, I don't think they are either.
Let's add up one point, which is that we have, let's say, 24 plus 15,000 doses, which means 20,000 vaccines. I mean, to get an immunity, you have to get two doses, as far as I'm aware. So yet it is something, but it's very little. So maybe, as Pashinyan said, we will get 1 million of doses of Sputnik V from Russia. Maybe that, if we have, will change situation. But I don't think really that it is a case. And also I want to add up one more thing, which is maybe some other versions of, let's say, South African, British, Brazilian versions of mutations of coronavirus have some spread in Armenia, but at least within the general population, their share should be very small, because I have a big database on coronavirus in Armenia with dozens of synthetic indicators counted, and to be frank, yet I don't see anything unusual. So either this version these mutations do not differ that much, or their share is small, because in the global scale, in the national scale, let's say, what we can observe is just average third wave, which we could observe in other countries, which, by the way, is on decline. It did not decline much, but the top, the peak of this third wave has been achieved on, let's say, March 26 to 27, if we count on average number of cases.
Right, that
a
makes
week.
Sense.
So already two weeks is, it's very slowly but declining.
You were saying a little while ago that is not the case. Are you unsure that Armenia is going to get 1 million Sputnik V vaccines?
First of all, I don't see 500,000 people in Armenia that are going to make these vaccines. People are very skeptical about vaccines, and specifically about Sputnik, not Sputnik, but coronavirus vaccines. You know, there were many rumors,
yeah,
conspiracies, and very many fears, because the vaccines allegedly are not, let's say, well prepared. I don't know. But and people are afraid. According to the polls, only, let's say, about 20% of people are ready to get these vaccines. Technically, this is corresponding to 1 million of doses. But majority of these people already had contacted to the virus, so they already have an immunity. And on the other hand, 1 million of doses is a very big number. And if you look at what happens in Russia, they also have a very limited vaccination scale compared to, for example, Israel. And I don't think Russia can be ready to provide this many vaccines to Armenia only.
Right. As far as I know, Putin announced sometime earlier this week that they're ramping up their Sputnik V vaccine production. So they're going to have plenty, supposedly, in the coming future.
One correction, one comment. Sorry, Asmet. One comment is that even though people have the immunity, even if they contract the vaccine and have immunity towards it, this is one of the other things that we still don't know, and we cannot speculate that what is the outcome of the vaccination, or what is the outcome of getting the immunity or contracting the virus, right? Even with the virus now, with the vaccination, there are talks that now that regardless of which vaccine you get, you will be needing a booster in 6 months, not an annual sort of vaccine, but a booster. And the other thing is that the different variants of the vaccine, some of the different variants of COVID-19 actually might be immune to the vaccines that are out there, some of the vaccines.
At so least for
so many factors. And it's, yeah, and someone has to tell people, like, science is science, regardless if you believe in it or not. But
so that's my next question.
No one is doing that.
Asped and Hrant, you are both living in Yerevan. Two questions about that. Are you aware of a campaign by the government that is trying to convince people that vaccination is a good thing, and when it's available, to please take it? And number two, do you see a difference in acceptance of the vaccination between the Yerevan population and the Armenian population in general in the country?
Okay. Well, first, let me speculate a little on vaccination effectiveness. Now we have one country which has achieved herd immunity through vaccination, which is Israel. And we see very sharp decline in infection rates. I mean, hundreds of times decline. And it seems, yet speculatively, because there might be some other factors, but it seems that it might be working. Now, concerning Armenia, I'm sure there is difference between Yerevan and provinces. And if I remember it correctly, from the poll data we got, let's say, half a year ago, there was significant difference based on education, on income level, and so on. Now, concerning, which also correlates to the place of living. And the next thing is, does the government tell people that they need vaccination? I think before it did not, because we did not have vaccines. And if we have significant number of vaccines, I think they will start campaign because they already are said Armenia is going to start some scale of vaccination beginning on April 13 to 14. So I think they will start the campaign based on the number of vaccines available.
I agree. I mean, in terms of the difference between the regions and Yerevan, definitely it's there. And, you know, I have been checking the health ministry's website, and even when they want to do things, but they are not prepared to do it, even in terms of setting up a registry, which is not easy to find, where you pre-register to be considered for the vaccine or not. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a mess in that sense. On the contrary, if you compare at least the virtual aspect of it in Georgia and neighboring Georgia, you see that their website on their health minister or COVID-19 is actually much better, even though they're planning on vaccinating their population with Sinopharm, which is, as of now, does not have data.
When you say that there is a difference between the Yerevanites and the rest of the population, do you find the Yerevanites more accepting of vaccines?
Relatively speaking, yeah.
Yeah, moving on to our last topic, we wanted to cover a little bit of economic issues. Needless to say, the past year has been a very difficult time for Armenia. First, the coronavirus pandemic hit us 13 months ago, and we had the July border skirmishes, and then the third Artsakh. The Armenian economy has suffered badly. Last year's economic decline is officially set at 7.6%. Right now, there is rampant inflation, officially estimated to be around 6%. But if you look at the consumer basket, many daily essentials have gotten more expensive by 10, 20, 30% or even more. Harant, in the US, they say that the virus is in charge of the economy, meaning that for the economy to improve, we have to deal with the virus first. We already talked a little bit about this, but do you think that this is also the case?
Well, theoretically, I agree with what they say in US. This is based on research done by Berkeley scientists back in March 2020, which was comparison between regions and countries who have dealt with the Spanish flu in 1918. So they found out that those countries and states which have dealt with the virus itself better and which had on their term sometimes stricter lockdown measures, they got out of this trouble faster, and they started recovering faster, and they had less troubles. Now concerning Armenia, of course, a virus is still affecting the economy. Also, in terms of having relatively closed borders with many countries who don't consider Armenia as safe destination or safe country, but currently, concerning the dram exchange rate, concerning the consumer prices growth, and especially, as was mentioned, the growth of grocery prices, this is more connected to the war, because compared to COVID, it's one difference. COVID has very direct impact on Armenian economy, on economy of the Republic of Armenia, and the day you remove COVID, the day the social activity will recover completely, the day the tourism will recover completely, you will remove this impact as well. Of course, if you have the global economy recovered as well. But the war consequences are more long-term. Of course, we have losses in Artsakh itself, and which we should remember, Artsakh had one economic zone. So losses in Artsakh technically affect Armenia as well. But the consequences of the war for the Republic of Armenia are much long-term rather than short-term, which are consequences of COVID. So the share of consequences of COVID is quickly declining in the overall decline rate and overall problems related to the economy, while share of problems related to the war is growing.
Okay, on the flip side of the economy, the Prime Minister has promised to raise the salary of certified teachers by 30 to 50% and to increase the funding for science to over 2 billion dirhams. I mean, these sound great, but with an economy that is down a lot and the central bank predicting anemic growth of around 2%, I think, where's the money coming from, Asped?
Well, if you find out, please do let me know, and probably you need to notify the Prime Minister as well. I think there's a lot of, I think the 30 to 50% is something that the government has been talking about for a while now, even before the war, constantly raising about the salaries of public employees and so on and so forth. But with the current inflation and the cost of living rising, I know of a lot of private institutions, various with various sizes, who are actually exploring the possibility of increasing salaries or payments to their employees by an average of about 3 to 5%. Again, depending on the companies and on the institutions. At least I know of half a dozen of cases like that. But in the case of Armenia, I think this is probably again another a campaign promise. I think it would fall within the context of campaign promise.
You
And
took the
also, don't
words right out of
forget,
my
I want to
mouth.
add something. I want to add one thing about what Hrant mentioned as well about the currency devaluation. I'm also seeing, not in a ma on a mass scale, but I am seeing that there are probably currency manipulation on the market in terms of sometimes. There was a couple of days ago. It was the dirham was evaluated artificially, and then it jumped back up. I mean, the exchange it devaluated again, and this is something that I'm very well familiar in. What happened in many countries, including in Lebanon, back in the mid to late '80s, where currency exchange became a major tool for people to make money out of. So I am concerned about that as well. Again, there are more regulations in Armenia than there were in Lebanon in the 1980s, but still, that is not something that we should be forgetting.
I want to agree because I think as of now, this might become an important issue. Now, not only Lebanon, but Armenia itself has this experience back in 2008 when the global crisis started. Armenia's central bank started artificially increasing dirham rate, let's say, or keeping it on the stable level while the real exchange rate was declining. So at one day on March 3, 2009, they have dropped the exchange rate from 306 to 372. Now, the bigger problem is not only that Armenia has, let's say, lived through the shock, but the bigger problem is that Armenia has lost about $700 million from its currency reserve, I mean central bank currency reserve, and it was wasted on dirham rate keeping just for several months. And ultimately, Armenia had to get new loans to refill their central bank depository. Now, concerning current situation, it is obvious that the dirham rate is manipulated because before the decline started, let's say the stable exchange rate was, well, more or less stable exchange rate. In the, let's say, beginning of March, it was about 525. Then it started slowly devaluating, and at some point it achieved 544. And the very same day, central bank started interventions. They have declared. They said they are working on the currency market, and one of the MPs stated that they are making interventions. And my real concern is that now exchange rate of dirham has already increased to the level it had not achieved even until it was somehow stable. So it's now 513 to 525. So which means that central bank is even increasing dirham rate, not only keeping it on the way on the level it has been there, but increasing it. And the problem is here that I'm sure some of people, or maybe even many of people, will start dollarization of their deposits. So central bank will finance dollarization of some actives, especially if we count that there might be some insider deals, which also happened in 2008 and 9. So at that time, central bank was spending this $700 million, and those people who had big deposits, they got this money. So now it might be again this the very same situation.
So as we mentioned, the prediction for the Armenian economy's growth for 2021 is around 2% by the central bank. There's also rosier predictions by some cabinet members, like for 6 or even 7, 6% or even double-digit growth. And we're seeing a lot of obviously news over the past few weeks in terms of successes in the economy, increased tax collection, or they're able to fulfill their tax collection plans. How does an average person navigate this news, Herant? What is Do you see any basis for all this optimism that is being pushed out through the news media? And what prism can we use to look to see the most, the closest thing to objectivity here?
Well, the problem with this news is that they are not verifiable. For example, when we hear that the circulation of some taxes, let's say VAT tax collection has grown or something, and then we look at statistical data, we don't see growth of trade, we don't see a growth of tax collection as well, I mean the budget. And the problem is, where this data come from? I assume that the Prime Minister is getting some set of data from different authorities, and then he's cherry-picking something, which sometimes he even himself does not understand. But some of the indicators which might be improving clearly, and then he presents it as a whole picture. So this is a problem. Now, statistical data is being published monthly at a stable, let's say, interval of time, and we can really check what is happening there. Concerning economic growth, to be more exact, the central bank's estimation is 1.4% growth, while some other institutions are expecting up to 3%, and as you said, the Minister of Economy is expecting double-digit growth. I have conducted my calculation as well, and it might seem optimistic, which is about plus 5% growth, which is based on seasonal trends, because last year we had sharp decline, not in the beginning of the year, but in the mid-year, while having lockdowns and so on. So, on the contrast to the low basis of COVID year and of the year of the war, we might get 5% growth, let's say. But
And
we should not completely call it growth. It should be called rather recovery than growth.
that
And
makes
also it
sense.
should be called partial recovery.
And that does not include also inflation, right? So if inflation is more than the growth, then
Yeah,
you
inflation will
can.
eat into the growth.
No. This 5% includes inflation. While we're talking about salaries growth, it does not include inflation, so you should deflate the salary growth. And this is a problem. We have, for example, let's say 2% salary growth, and the real salary growth percent is minus 4. Now, with the GDP growth, it does deflate the prices growth, so GDP growth is cleared from the inflation effects.
Herant, don't you think 5% growth is optimistic? If tourism doesn't pick up because the country's vaccination process has not advanced adequately, a lot of tourists may just hold off on traveling to Armenia. In general, at this point, I'm hearing a lot of people around me planning their summer trips, but this year, not so much.
Well, not as bad. In reality, not as bad. We had 1,867,000 incoming tourists in 2019. In 2020, we had something around 330,000, out of which majority came in January and February. Now we have we are observing slow recovery of tourism, first from Russia. It's let's say it's going to climb up to, let's say, 600,000 to 700,000. No, yeah, probably 600,000 to 700,000 annually. So it will be still around 3 times less than 2019, but it will be significantly more than crisis months of 2020. And it does not include that Armenia will completely open. If Armenia will completely open, the numbers will grow even beyond beyond 600,000 or 700,000. Now, concerning Glendale, the thing is that Armenia's, let's say, borders are partially opened with Russia and Georgia, but not with US yet. So maybe the day the borders will open, you might observe that, but it does not mean that there is no tourism at all, because as of now, we can see some Russian tourists here. Not very many, not as many as used to be, but we can already observe them, and we did not see them, let's say, 1 year ago.
Well, Glendale has very special and open borders with Hayastan.
Yeah.
Okay, well, this seems like a good spot to stop. Thank you, everyone, for your time, and thanks for our listeners, and talk to you next week.
Thank you, Obik. Thank you,
Aspect. Until next week.
Thank you.
That concludes our program for this Week in Review episode. We hope it has helped your understanding of some of the issues from the previous week. We look forward to your feedback and your suggestions for issues to cover in greater depth. Contact us on our website at grung.org or on our Facebook page, ANN-Grung, or in our Facebook group, Grung-Armenian News Network. Special thanks to Laura Osborne for providing the music for our podcast. On behalf of everyone in this episode, we wish you a good week. Don't forget to subscribe to our channels, like our pages, and follow us on social media. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.